mystery and horror. The air itself is filled with monsters.
Children of the night, what music they make.
He's alive! He's alive!
Well, hello, all you monster fiends, and thank you for joining us for another deep dive, factoid-filled episode exploring Hollywood's most famous monsters. I am your mistress of ceremony, Sam, and I am joined, as always, by Dan from Bleeding Marvelous. Say hello, Dan.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
All right.
All right. Hi, Dan. thanks for joining us for another episode of the Monsters of North podcast. Oh, today is going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Today is going to be a different vibe because we're not recording at night.
Monsters in the morning.
We're more awake than we are usually. Yeah, we're doing a daytime recording, so the vibe's going to be very different.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want to do is do the disclaimer and then get into this week's episode. Sure, everything discussed in today's episode is our opinions and our opinions alone. If you'd like to discuss anything from today's episode, please come and join us on the Facebook page, the Discord, or the comment section, where we can have an open discussion. About what we won't have is anyone coming for us and telling us our opinions are wrong. We can all agree to disagree in fandom. So let's keep it fun, keep it kind, and keep the toxic behavior out of nerdism.
Don't be a dick.
As she said. It's so funny. I watched the first episode the other day, and we have generally been saying your bit of the opening since the very start.
That's 55 episodes, I think.
My beginning part changed a lot, but the whole Dan from Bleeding Marvelous, say hi, Dan, that has literally been from episode one.
Yeah, that's I am. Yeah, 50. This will be episode 54.
54.
So we've been going over a year now.
Wow.
Of episodes, anyway. So.
Whoop, whoop. Yeah, that's true, because we started, what, in the May?
May 2023.
Look how far we've come. Look how many people we've covered. And today is a new one. A new person to join the pantheon of her monsters up north. So, William Torb Hooper.
Mm-hmm.
Torby Hooper!
I'm just going to let you keep doing it.
No, you're not. William Torby Hooper, born January 25th, 1943, was an American filmmaker best known for his work in the horror genre. The British Film Institute cited Hooper as one of the most influential horror filmmakers of all time. His impact on horror cinema was groundbreaking, with films like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and his versatile storytelling in Poltergeist and Life Force. He's here as Monsters Up North brings you a Torby Hooper.
Well, that's all my facts you've just done, so I'm going
to should we just wrap this up now?
Yeah, that's all it's done. Done, dusted.
For a man who is so, if you look at any interviews or articles, he is so like hailed up there as one of the big uns, one of the big guns. Go and try and find some information out on him.
Yeah, I tried scandals, I tried arguments, I tried looking in newspapers, like I tried everything just to find something that was of substance, that was about him specifically, not about the movies he's done, but about him specifically. Maybe a paragraph or two that's slightly different depending where I look, but had the same kind of vibe to it. Good God, this man was private. And I mean, that is a hell of an achievement to receive
mm-hmm.
in being in the... in the limelight, so to speak. He managed to keep his himself very away from that, from what I think, which is got all power to him, but really
it didn't help us right now. Not us right now. It even was to the point where he was his first marriage was well known, but nobody knew he was divorced for nearly 13 years until he was like, "Oh no, I'm remarried. Like I've been divorced from that person." Like they generally didn't know. That's how private he actually is. And up until I started doing the notes for this, I'm going to be honest and say, I just thought he was known for Texas Chainsaw and Poltergeist. Not the case.
I knew he'd done a lot, but I didn't know that there was only very few well-known things. I mean, if you are a huge stan for Toby Hooper, then you'll know all of his stuff. But if you're somebody who dips their toe in, you're only going to know certain things, certain films. So, you know, you'll know who he is because he created horror as we know it. True. This man is responsible for a movie that came out in 1974 that kick-started gore to a degree, because people don't realize the hassle that man went through to try and get his certifications.
Oh yeah, I read about
for that. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and how he went about it was fantastic. All the hypotheticals.
Yeah. We'll start at the, to be honest, it started at the very beginning, because Texas Chainsaw is very close to the beginning. His first, see, when we've done other people, we've had background on like where they came from, how they got into this. The only thing that is known is that he got into filmmaking at such a young age by recording on an 8mm.
Yeah.
That's as far as we know. When he goes to, well, college, what would be our university, he then goes into filmmaking, which is very similar to how Neil described his start, was doing it that way. And he did a film called Eggshells.
Yes. And he called that the hippie film.
The hippie film. So that was in 1969. And it was made for $40,000.
Yeah, he said that if you go back and watch it now, you just see it's a bunch of hippies, basically. He said they were all like proper what you would call hippies of the time. They didn't really wash much. They were all very much of the, like, I live on the land and... Oh, you know, those guys.
Love the trees.
So it took a lot longer to film than he had anticipated, because trying to wrangle a bunch of hippies to do what you want when they're like, no, man, I'll do what I want. It's my man.
Well, shortly after, like literally the next thing he does after that, which is technically kind of a college/university film, he does Texas Chainsaw.
Well, there is a documentary in between. I think it came before.
Yes.
He did, 1971. He did a TV movie, documentary for Peter, Paul and Mary, who are, if people don't know who they are, they were quite big, like, trio in America in the late 60s, early 70s. And they sung songs like Puff the Magic Dragon. They're most famous for doing a lot of covers, but they did If I Had a Hammer, which we all used to sing at school at some point. I know we all did.
If I Had a Hammer.
We used to sing that in like Common Praise. It was like in our hymn books in like junior school. And then they did Leaving on a Jet Plane, which was John Denver, but they covered that. And then they also covered a load of Bob Dylan stuff, Blowing in the Wind and all that. So they became really famous for doing that. So he did like a TV documentary on them. And that sort of gave him a bit of awareness to be able to raise enough money to finance Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah.
So what I read, but
yeah. <it's>,
So
yeah, I remember reading about the documentary, but it wasn't enough to put it in my notes apparently.
Yeah.
So yeah, after the documentary is then the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the movie that is cited for revolutionizing the slasher genre. And also the gore genre as well, and how it was actually what people would class as tastefully done.
And it was tastefully done for the sheer reason that if he'd have gone to where he wanted to go to, he wouldn't have got a film classification for it to be able to have been released in the cinema. So He had ideas.
From what I remember reading, did he want to go for a PG on this one?
He wanted to be able to get people bums on seats. So
Right.
for him, the best option would be to get as many people in the cinema as he could. So when they originally started the film, there was a loose script made, but there wasn't a. We didn't know Leatherface was going to be the Leatherface we know now. That was down to Gunnar Hansen to play him and get him, you know. There was no hard and fast rule that Leatherface was going to be emotionally challenged, so to speak. I don't really know the right way because there's no official diagnosis on what.
No, there wasn't. And if I remember rightly from our Leatherface episode, we were very careful on how we diagnosed Leatherface.
That, so as there was no official sort of diagnosis for him, he tried to. Gunnar Hansen decided he wanted to make him emotionally stunted in a way so he'd be a lot younger mentally than he would should be for his age. But his comprehension was to do as he's told. That was pretty much he was a puppet in many ways. But that was Gunnar's choice. So Gunnar took it to Toby and sat him down and went, right, this is what I think I would like to do to play him. And Toby was like, do you know what? That would be really cool. So we're gonna have to bump it from a PG to out like the version of a 15. But there were so many scenes in it that caused issues with the cinema classification board. They certified it as an N, which is a no certification, which means he wouldn't have been able to show it in the cinemas.
Wow.
So he had to find out ways of reducing it, but he didn't get it officially classified as an N because he did that thing. We talked about it just before we came on. We both saw an interview with Mick Garris, who is the director of Critters 2 onwards and
But he
many,
is a
many other
huge,
things.
he's like a huge like horror historian is
Yeah, Mick
how
Garris is
I would
like,
know him.
he's always on all the darkness. If you see all the darkness documentaries, 1, 2, and 3, Mick's always on those.
Very, very different to how he looked in the interview I saw. Because I was like, oh my God,
Much
he's got short
shorter.
hair.
Yeah, usually Mick's got really long hair,
Long.
but he was interviewing Toby and he was asking him these questions, and Toby was not very forthcoming. That I felt sorry for him.
No.
That must have been like him blood out of a stone trying to interview him, but
It was for post-mortem, a show that Mickey used to do. And it was, oh, it was like drawn teeth. I was
it
like, oh, come on, give him a bit more. Like, Mick knows more than you at this point.
He was like, he said to him, you know, how did you get around being able to show what you wanted to show with it being so unprecedented? I mean, no one had seen a woman hung on a meat hook before. You know, no one had seen any of these things because you've got to remember, this is 1974. Horror films we're used to seeing in that sort of around that era, up until that era, was like he said, Christopher Lee rising out of a coffin or Vincent Price stalking around a house or just spooky dookie stuff. There was no gore, wasn't a thing. Like actual physical, messy, violent death wasn't a thing you saw in movies. It just wasn't. And unless you like went to, I don't even think they even existed at that point. Like B movie, like harsh.
No.
I don't even think that was a thing then. I mean, I could be completely wrong and someone will tell me I'm wrong, and that's fine. I'm not claiming to know the answer to this. I'm just saying that from what I've seen, it seems like this was the first of its kind, this
Well,
movie.
yeah, just
This.
think. Well, think back on where we were last week with prom night, and not that fucking one that we that whatever it was. But the
Abomination.
original, one, that's the 80. That's 1980. That's so. This is just before. I'm trying to picture it. Where it is in. So in horror history, this is around the time of religious horror. This is your Rosemary Baby, your The Omen's about. So yeah,
Exorcist
this is
came out and it
The
had to come out
Exorcist.
by this.
So this isn't having women impaled onto what was it, meat hook, and having someone's brains bashed in with a hammer, and to see it. Because usually it'd be a trick of the camera kind of thing in slashes to that point. Like, you wouldn't necessarily. Like, look at Psycho, for example. You don't see that knife going into it. You know that it has, but you don't see it. It's just all implied. Toby didn't do that. He fucking showed you.
Yeah. And that scene that he was talking about was the way he got around showing that scene and it's still getting the rating that it got a better rating was that there was no blood. When he lifted her up and put her on the hook, you saw the bathtub underneath. This is all according to that interview because you'll know what I'm saying here, but you saw the bathtub underneath and you knew that inferred that what he was going to do, there was blood on the wall, but there was no blood from her. So that's how they got around being able to do a lot of the more gruesome kills. Because if you remember these things, you remember them covered in blood. Everything's covered in blood. It's terrible. The whole movie's blood. And it's not, if you go back and watch that film, there's not as much as you think. It's dirty and it's gritty. And the only scene that I recall there being a lot of blood is the final scene where Sally's running away and she's covered in blood. But other than that.
But she was alive. She wasn't being hurt. She was alive.
Exactly. So other than that, I can't recall any of the kills being bloody. So we all think of it as like a gore fest. And it is to the degree of the murders that they do commit are harsh. They are crazy. They are unlike anything you'd seen at the time. But there wasn't that much blood. So there wasn't,
if any, this, he was very good with noise. Mm-hmm. I think that's the bonus part. And it's, I always, every time I think of Texas Chainsaw, I think of that hammer scene when he clonks him on the head and you hear the clonk and you hear his shoes. It's his shoes that I can hear when they're rattling because he's obviously his body's in shock and his whole, you know, nervous system is going crazy. And then you can hear the pigs as well going apeshit. And it's like, it's the noise element. I'm not looking for blood or guts and gut. It's the noise that gets me. He was very good at that.
He wrote the soundtrack, didn't he? He scored the whole of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And he also scored the Eaten Alive, I think, as well. But like the two movies he scored.
He was very good at doing things on a budget. This is actually technically classed as a very low budget movie.
Indie,
that was the word I was looking for. Indie movie. It was co-written with Kim Hinckley. Didn't even say that at all. It says Henkel. It was co-written with Kim Hinckley, and they were very good at being able to do things on the budget. To make it that indie. And I think this is why it's so renowned is because of the, not just the film itself. The film itself is absolutely brilliant. I love it. It is one of my favorites. It's because I can't believe that Gunnar Hansen actually got me to sympathize with his character. I think that's like the shock of it for us. And like this is why I keep going back to it is because of him. But I've totally lost my train of thought.
the thing about him was that he didn't care if the actors liked him or not. He wasn't part of a popularity contest, Toby. He didn't give a whether you liked him or not. It was all about the end result. It was all about what they could put out, which in a way, that's got to be difficult working with someone like that. Mm. But then in the same vein, it got the result that we have today, so it couldn't have been, it must have been worth it in one way, because Ed Neil was cited as saying, I think it was Ed Neil, you know, the guy who played the cousin.
Ed
Neil. He said the making of the movie was worse than his service in Vietnam.
Wow, that's so, a bold statement.
He said basically that, I mean, we talked about it in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre episodes, about the heat level that was going on in that first movie. It was 110 degrees on the last day in Texas, and it was a 27-hour day, their last day shooting, which I know you go, oh, Daniel, there's 24 hours in a day. What I mean is they didn't stop for 27 hours. They went straight through to get everything that they needed. And
Maybe because he was, to start with, he was doing things on a 16-hour day, which in the movie industry is quite a short day. So hence why they probably ramped it up towards the end.
he said when he was making this film, every trope he'd seen in cinema up until that point, he wanted to break it. He wanted to to make it something that wasn't seen before. Because now we look at that movie and we go, oh yeah, that happens, this happens, man. Because we've been spoiled. At that point, these things hadn't been done. Like in that interview with Mick, he basically said that he didn't just have Sally jump out of one window. He had her jump out of two, or he would have a jump out of three just because one is the norm. So he wanted to make it different. Like he'd have Gunnar chasing someone with a chainsaw four or five times rather than just for once for the big ending. Or, you know, there was these things that would be, he'd take it to that like where you think, oh God, is this done now? And it'd be like an extra layer of, oh, we've got to wait another minute or so of him doing that before he's done. Because he wanted that uncomfortability. He wanted that, he wanted
Oh,
you to feel
absolutely.
when you watched it. So
Oh, absolutely. Well, the movie is based on the murders of Ed Gein, and I knew, obviously, we know that. I didn't realize that the other one was Elma Wayne Henley. I can't remember if we ever mentioned that in the Leatherface episode, because that was last year, people. And a lot has happened since then. And I went down a bit of a rabbit hole with Elma Wayne Henley today. Don't like it.
he's not the pig guy, is he?
No.
No.
No. No. There is another one later on, which I went down another rabbit hole with, and I'll get to when we get to it. Because he has a tendency, so I don't know if you've ever noticed or even thought about this, but he has a type, does our Toby Hooper. Films based around Texas, or films based around Texan serial killers.
He was born and bred in Texas, so I suppose
Exactly,
it is like
yeah.
a
He's stick to
thing.
what you know. He managed to, obviously managed to, he did it for 140,000 Texas Chainsaw, and it brought in 30 million.
It was insane amount of money because people were like, we've got to see what this is all about. Why is there a guy with a chainsaw? What's he got a mask on for? All that sort of stuff. So it became like this huge, it was the most successful independent movie until Halloween came out in 1979. So it held the record from 1978, sorry. So it held the record for 4 years of the most successful financial independent movie for 4 years. And then John Carpenter bought out
And
Halloween.
shit all over it.
So, but I mean, John must have taken some sort of inspiration from Toby
Oh,
because Toby took
massively.
that first step. John took his bits from Black Christmas, as we well know, like all the first person stuff. So John was watching other directors. John was watching other filmmakers do psychological horror, do gore horror. So that's how John got to where he got with Michael at that point. You know, it
Oh, absolutely. Isn't John just getting his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame?
Yeah, he is. But people don't know that you have to pay for those.
When was it? Ralph Garman, who, if he's a Kevin Smith had a podcast called Hollywood Babylon, and Ralph Garman, who was part of the Garman Report, and he did a radio show in Los Angeles. He's in Ted. He's the dad in Ted. He's in million. He works a lot with Seth MacFarlane, voice work, like small bit roles. He paid or fundraised Adam West's star, and holy shit, the numbers to actually get a star is ridiculous. Ridiculous. And the upkeep.
It's the upkeep. You have to pay for the rental of the space for the star. Basically, you pay for your pitch. So you pay your first amount for the wherever you want to have it. So the more expensive would be the more into Man's Theatre area, the main part of Hollywood Boulevard itself. The further out you go, the cheaper it gets. So
Oh,
obviously,
yeah.
you know, it is what your budget is. However, it's insane for the initial, and then every year you have to pay for it to be upkept. And by upkept, all it means is you just have to pay for your rental. So that is never yours, even though you're there, it's never specifically your star. So you're talking millions and millions to get your initial pitch, and then at least a million or so a year to keep it there, depending on where you are on the walk. So, you know, for people to say, I've got a star, it's like, it's great, but you've paid for that.
Yeah, I know Robert England's just getting his as well. So it's nice. I love the idea of it, but when you look at like the money side of it, you're like, is it worth it? Is
Yeah,
it?
there's some really random places for some of them because obviously times change, things
Yeah.
move. Boris Karloff's on a crossing. He's on a crosswalk that you
Yeah.
go down to walk across.
I
It's
remember
in
you
a
telling
really
us
strange
that.
place. Like Muhammad Ali has one, and it's on the wall as you walk into the. You've got like a shopping center, like Hollywood and Highland, at the inside of that. It's just as you go to walk in. He's got a huge one, like three times bigger than
Of
anybody on the
course he
floor, but
does.
it's on the wall. And it's all these random like people you wouldn't expect to be out the front or out the front of there, like people that aren't
Yeah.
necessarily as like you got all the handprints. I'm gonna talk about those. I'm talking about the actual physical stars. You got some really random ones, and it's odd.
Oh, this has been your Hollywood catch up with Sam and Dan. Where are we? It's 1974. So his next film is Eaten Alive, 76.
Yes.
This is the one with. So again, this is written by his writing partner Henkel. While he was making Texas Chainsaw, he actually put together his production company named Vortex, which is obviously what uses for Eaten Alive. I think this is the one with the other, which is this is this alligator one, right?
No, there is a crocodile movie called Crocodile that you
Is
did.
that yeah, right, that's that one then. So it's not this one. I don't know what this one is.
Yeah, I to be honest with you, there's a lot where he bangs through like B movie after B movie in a very short spirit like period of time.
Oh no, this is this one. This
Is this
is
the one
this
where
one.
they all get eaten? Because
This
this.
is the alligator one. Yeah. So this is the one, as the Salem Massacre, it's a film based on a serial killer. And the serial killer is called Joe Ball.
And it's
This is
Robert
the
England.
yes,
Yes,
aha.
yeah.
So this serial killer is called Joe Ball. Now, I'm gonna use the air quote serial killer because we don't actually know. So what happened was in Texas in the 1930s, 20s, 30s, two women went missing in this small town. And it was very unheard of. And it all came about that Joe Ball might have been, am I saying that right? Yeah, Joe Ball might have been involved in it. So when the police went to go and question him, he shot himself.
As you do.
So nobody actually knows if he did it. Apparently, one of his friends said, yeah, he did it, and he fed them to the alligators. That
Oh, yeah.
guy.
Yeah.
That, but it was all, they weren't sure. Nobody was actually sure. His wife was like, he may have killed them. She didn't come out until years later and go, she may have killed them, but definitely didn't feed them to the alligators. I can 100% confirm that. So nobody actually has definite proof that this man, I mean, his actions kind of potentially speak for what he may not have done, but. Yeah, it was a weird one that I was reading about today. I was like, what the fuck? Why would you just shot him? He shot himself in the heart. Even though people said he shot himself in the head, he didn't. He shot himself in the heart. His autopsy proved that. So that's where this story comes about. And when I looked at the poster, I went, oh my God, mortal hell. Like,
I know, I feel like I've seen it, but I don't think I have. It's one of those movies that the synopsis sounds really familiar. The little out, you know, like in some of the videos on YouTube I've been watching, you see little clips and I think that looks familiar, but I don't think I've watched it. Like I feel like I have, but I don't think I have. I think there's something out there a bit similar, so.
poor Joe for the rest of his life. I say poor Joe, he potentially could have murdered two women, but he would forever be known as the Alligator Man or the Butcher of Elmendorf.
Oh dear, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, that's his names. I say just for killing two women. That is not what I meant at all. But he, the nobody, there's no proof. His by all accounts, his friend could have done it, but again. His actions kind of speak for themselves in a
Yeah.
way. So I'm going to use the word allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah.
So yeah, Eaten Alive was done on a soundstage in California to save on costs. Again, he was very good at saving on costs. He wrote the music himself, produced it himself.
Something he did on Texas Chainsaw Massacre as well to save money was he'd be the director, the DP, the first DP. He'd then go and do edit it. He'd also do lighting. He'd do have say on costumes. He'd have say because he controlled the budget. He needed to make sure that everybody understood that this was all that they had. So he would play every part. And I've got to be honest, that would be really hard to work for someone that would be that controlling. And I understand why he is like that because that's how my brain works. You know, if I know what's going on everywhere, I can plan for a bigger picture. So it's probably very innocent in that respect, but to work for somebody who's that organized would be an absolute fucking nightmare.
Yeah, a lot of people walked away from him at certain points. The guy who was writing the music with him for Eaten Alive, William Bell, walked away from him. So you can kind of, meh.
If I'm right in saying William Bell's done quite a lot though, his name sounds incredibly familiar. I feel like he's done a lot of soundtracks and scores over the years for something. That name sounds familiar, unless it's just very familiar to like similar to
This
something
is
I've heard
how
before.
bad my, this is how dirty my glasses are. It doesn't say William Bell at all. It says Wayne Bell.
Okay, well then
What
I
the
take
fuck?
that
Hold on.
back.
I really can't see that. But he walked off. He walked off and left him, which, to be honest, in his interviews, I can understand why. It sounds like he doesn't have a personality.
It doesn't seem to be able to put across what it is he needs quite. He's not very
That's better.
eloquent. Does that make sense? Like he can't express it. He can't say, right, this is what I need because it's all up here. So he needs to do it to get it out, which
He's incredibly creative, and we will get to how creative he actually is when we move on to another one of his big hitters, because that was a minefield that I went through today, looking through that and people's interpretation on it and what actually happened. But his next thing is the first time he gets some real dollar, which is when he does Salem's Lot. And TV, television, it's the
That one.
same thing.
Yep.
The TV, I'm gonna say it again, the television miniseries of Salem's Lot in 1979. This is where he gets his first bit of money.
Yeah, this was a three part, wasn't it? Now, a lot of people know Salem's Lot for that one scene where the kid's outside the window, banging on the window, you know, the let me in scene thing.
I've never seen Salem's Lot. I don't actually know the story of it. I
It's just
Carolyn, my best friend, kicks off with me because it's one of her favorites. Never seen it.
Salem's Lot is a Stephen King novel, as most people should know, because if you don't, come on now. It's had numerous sequels. I don't know if they were all Stephen King approved sequels or they were just sequels that people made off their own back, but it had a remake done in the 90s with Rob Lowe as
Is
well.
Rob Lowe in it?
Yeah, he also Rob Lowe was also in The Stand, the original Stand movie that they well, the TV miniseries that they did before the remake with Amber Turd and
Ugh.
what's his name? Skarsgård, Alex. Yeah, he was in the original TV made for TV movie off the back of doing the Salem's Lot remake. But Salem's Lot is about a bunch of vampires that come to town and they just try and convert the village basically. But it's a bit more than that when you get into it. They have like a Nosferatu-y style vampire. It's like it's not vampires, you know, like the romantic Anne Rice vampires.
Oh, I like that.
These are like the Nosferatu, like pointy teeth, pointy ears, like we're going to come and eat you in your sleep kind of guys. And the guy who played the vampire, Reggie, he had to have his makeup applied every time he was on screen because it cracked constantly because they'd skimped on the budget with his makeup
Oh no.
to from other stuff. So when you see the big grey like Salem's Lot vampire, he every time he had to do an expression, they had to then stop, reapply, stop reapply because it cracked because the amount of layers of this effect, whatever that happened with that, it just didn't go down well.
You
And in the
sure?
end, it turned out that he'd only got, after all of this, bearing in mind it's a three-part mini series, 90 seconds of airtime. After all the editing and everything,
No.
he only got, as the main vampire, he only got 90 seconds of airtime. And it turned out he actually wasn't all that bothered. He found it quite amusing. He was quite flattered by the fact he got 90 seconds because he said it made people fear him more being on less than it would have if they've overused him as a
Oh, well,
character.
I like
So,
that he's looking at the overall story and not just opposed to, oh, I missed out. Yeah, I like that, but I don't. There's one thing I never agree on when it comes to trying to save money. You should never scrimp and save on makeup. You are touching someone's face.
yeah.
Like, no, you should be very careful with what you're applying to people and the amount of time that they have to sit with that makeup on as well. And if you have to constantly reapply it, I don't think that's something you should be having to budget on.
Yeah, I mean, if you see any pictures of the Salem's Lot vampires,
I
they are
can picture them.
basically
Like
just.
I'm not blind. I get
No,
I'm not blind, but
but
I've seen them.
the original, the ones that they've just turned have all got like really bright contacts in, like orangey yellow contacts, and they've all got white pale faces. And that's as far as they went with those ones. But the older ones, obviously this guy, you can see it when they take when you Google the picture, he will be one of the first ones that come up, and you can see it is just caked. You know, when you go out on a night and there's a woman who just keeps banging it on the face, you know,
Yeah.
they just keep patting it on and patting it on, and over the night it gets worse and worse, and like their chin lines and cracks, and that's where they work with this makeup. So
We have a saying in the Northeast is putting it on with a trowel. Probably the same throughout the UK, to be honest. No, I do, it's just something I've never actually went to go and watch. I know the new Nosferatu trailer's just come out and all.
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet. I keep meaning to go and watch it. I've still got to catch up on my House of Dragons from this week, but
Oh,
yeah,
oh,
got to catch up on
oh,
that. So that's my job after
oh,
this.
oh, I love, oh, you're gonna enjoy it. I liked it. Such a strong episode on the back of what you got from the first episode.
Which was a bit weak, I have to say. I felt the first episode was a little bit weak. I was waiting for something. Not the end. The end was great of the episode, but leading up to that moment, it was just like, oh, I'm bored. Nothing was happening.
I kind of get what you mean. I was, but when that ending happened, it kind of overshadowed the
Yeah.
rest of it. This episode is fucking mwah,
Right.
like mwah. It is so good. There's so many good bits in it. Strong series, but this series I have never actually seen Salem's Lot. Or there was something I was going to say about makeup, and it's just totally fucking slipped my mind. Sorry, I'm not with it today. Even though we're shooting early, like I should be more with it. So after Salem's Lot, we're going into the 80s with Funhouse.
Yes, now apparently this was a huge movie and I feel like it passed me by. I know they did a remake of it, not so long ago.
I have seen it. Oh no, I have seen it. I
Yeah.
think should I had it on.
Yeah,
It,
it would have been.
yeah, if it was on shift, it's the one I'm thinking of. Oh my God, that is so unwatchable.
Yes. And the sad thing was, I'm sorry, Robert, but Robert Kurzman was responsible for all the effects on the remake. His son even played one of the characters in it. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking the prosthetics and work and stuff,
Oh,
but
I
when
would never mock the
it's
craftsmanship. It's just the
oh,
film itself
it's a
story
project to
was.
be tied to, yeah.
Yeah. There's a th there's something that I've noticed with the movies that like the ones that I'm not unfamiliar with. So he's got these like huge blockbusters, but in the midst of it, he's got other work. Now they're all kind of like, so if you look at Texas Chainsaw 2, and I'm jumping ahead a bit, but Texas Chainsaw 2 is it's funny. All of the other movies, apart from his blockbusters, are funny. Like Toby Hooper has a sense of humor.
That's what he was saying in that interview with Mick Garris, wasn't it? He said no one got the sense of humor in the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He said they were saying it was like it's past black, it's red humor, and he was like, I just people weren't getting the comedy in it, and I was like, I think they weren't getting the comedy because they were blindsided by the amount of violence they were actually witnessing. So there wasn't the balance that he intended it to have when he put it out. I don't pers that's just a personal opinion, you know. I feel like for a good reason that didn't come off as comedy. It came off, we wouldn't have what we have now if we didn't have this movie. So people interpreted it as a highly violent, serious kind of documentary style
Because there's no
movie.
room to breathe in it. There's no room to actually sit there and try and figure out if there is a joke in it because you're too busy concentrating on what you've just seen and then what you're about to see. Even when you're with the family and they're all sitting there laughing, you can't laugh with them because poor Sally is sitting at the end of the table screaming her head off. So there's no room for laughing. There is in Texas Chainsaw 2.
Yeah, because of Bill. I would say it's Bill's responsibility, that one.
I'm gonna, yeah, absolutely. So after the, it's actually the Fun House, sorry, not Fun House, the Fun House in 1981, we then go into his second blockbuster, which is Poltergeist in 1982.
Yeah, and this is the weird thing about this film, right? Steven Spielberg just decided he liked what he'd done, which is random because Steven Spielberg, as we all know, is this massive entity. And especially in the late 70s and 80s, Steven Spielberg was pretty much the god of all cinema. You know, if you got in a Steven Spielberg film, you made it, or you
Oh
got a
yeah.
Spielberg seal of approval, you've made it. Your movie was, you know. But if I'm right in saying this, there was something where he wasn't actually offered this movie first.
No, it wasn't.
He was offered another big blockbuster,
He
which,
was.
good God, could you have imagined if he got his hand on that? What the hell that would have been like?
He was a rich so Steven Spielberg from the Mick interview, Toby mentioned it on there that he is a huge fan of Texas Chainsaw. And he originally approached him to direct E.T.
What on earth would that film have been?
And he said no.
I don't blame him because I picture a world in which Toby Hooper was responsible for ET, because my brain cannot fathom what kind of script that must have been in its infancy for Steven Spielberg to have gone to Toby Hooper, who we only know for Texas Chainsaw and documentary style shooting.
And a movie called Eaten Alive that's about crocodile eating, so
Exactly, and all these little shorts that he did in college, you know. To go to him for a family-friendly alien invasion bloody movie, you know, it's like choices.
it sounds like Steven Spielberg, after I've been like doing a bit of deep diving on Poltergeist, is all about the space. It's all about because you've got Close Encounters of the Third Kind and you've got E.T. And if Toby Hooper wasn't involved in Poltergeist, you guys would have a very, very different movie than what you got. You would not have the classic that we have today. You would have Close Encounters of the Third Kind Part 2. That's the movie that you would have had. It was Toby Hooper who came in and completely changed and revolutionized what Spielberg had on paper originally.
This is why Poltergeist is one of Spielberg's far removed movies. Like when you look at Spielberg's history of movies that he's directly involved in, not just his companies, but like him himself, this movie was so far away in genre from anything that he'd ever up until that point that you'd seen him do. I mean, you're looking at you've got ET, you've got Raiders, you've got all the, you know, you've got the Indiana Jones at that point. He was also involved in Star Wars. People don't realize Spielberg had a lot to do with Star Wars with George Lucas. So, you know, there's a lot of things that he dipped his fingers into, but none of it was supernatural. It was all spacey, fantasy, adventure, action, that sort of stuff. So this is, I think it's one of his very Like, even Jaws was a horror for Spielberg. Don't get me wrong. Jaws was classed as a horror, but it's not a horror in the respect of the, it's
Of its
supernatural
one genre,
horror.
is it?
This is the thing. People always find, I think it's a monster movie. For me, Jaws is a monster movie, but it's a real life monster movie. It's not like a Frankenstein where it's fantasy, like monster. This is like, this could happen if you went to the sea. You could get eaten by a bloody shark, you know.
And hence the reason I won't go in the sea. And it
But
had nothing to do with Jaws, but I just won't.
that's as far as he dipped his toe in that kind of like genre. I mean, this is supernatural horror. This is a, to me, this is a whole different ball game for Spielberg. So for him to have green lighted this, he must have known Toby had something that he could bring to the table that he was not able to bring himself, even though Spielberg had such an input on this film, and people really don't like the fact that he didn't get writing credits for it.
So there's a lot of, I want to use the word conspiracy. When it comes down to the creation of this, I watched something earlier that said that Toby didn't actually direct any of it. He was there for one scene and one scene alone because Spielberg took over the whole entire thing. But going off the interview that he had with Mick, very clearly wasn't the case. After he described how they did, and this blows my mind that it's done in one shot, the kitchen scene with the table and chairs. That is a one shot. That is literally, there is no edit, there is no cut. There is, you look at the table, you move over with Mary Beth. Is it Mary Beth? Can't think. You move over with her to where her and Heather.
The kids.
What's Heather's surname?
O'Rourke.
O'Rourke. Oh my gosh. God. Can't believe I forgot that. And you move over with Heather O'Rourke and then you move back to see it. That is all done in one shot. That is all the crew pulling chairs out and moving away out of screen.
Yeah, I mean that's got to be a hell of a noise, like as well. So the fact that they were able to remove the noise in that section as well. I mean, I never realized. I thought that that would have been a cut and edit, but it makes sense that it was one shot with the way it pans to them, and then it literally stops and pans back, and it's not moving forward and backwards. It is literally just sweeping and then sweeping back again. So it doesn't change position, but it's enough to let you know that they've seen something, and what are we looking at? Oh, hang on a minute, that wasn't there. You know, it's stuff like that that movie gives you the heebie-jeebies, but not in a horror, like not in our traditional horror way, I think.
No,
This is a whole nother level because Spielberg wanted it to be a PG, a 15, or whatever the equivalent is in America. I think it ended up being the version of a PG in America, but it was a 15 here.
That would make sense.
So they were even going to unrate, not unrate it, but they weren't sure what kind of rating to give it in the UK, Poltergeist, because it was such a ambiguous film. It was about children, and that was the issue. It wasn't so much, there was no real blood and gore in this film. There's nothing like that.
There's nothing
So,
like that.
but it was the fact that it was about kids, and technically a kid abduction is what it's about in a weird way. You know, in a supernatural way, but then there was the strangulation of the other child with the
Oh, I
clown.
wish he succeeded. That kid did my head in. Oh, you know what you agree, you have to agree. That kid was annoying as shit.
Kid's up there on the list next to the Babadook kid. He's on the top five for
Oh,
sure.
fucking rights, is he? It just seems like when it comes to this movie, everyone loves to have a conspiracy or, the fact that it's a cursed movie.
It is on Cursed Movies. If you go and watch
I've
the
watched it.
Amazon series of Cursed Movies, the Poltergeist movie is on there. I think it curses and that are only worth the credence you give them. If you believe something is cursed, then it will be because you're giving it the power to be. If you don't believe in it, then it isn't because it's you're not giving it the energy it needs to
I
be a thing.
totally agree with you. I just it's just unfortunate timings. Like the thing is, Heather O'Rourke didn't die after you know, the third, it took a, it was a few years after the Poltergeist movies had been out, and she was misdiagnosed.
Purely and simply, it was misdiagnosed. Dominique Dunn, because her boyfriend strangled her to death in a front garden. That's
a
totally different thing. You know, Dominique Dunn, which is Griffin Dunn's sister from Griffin Dunn, was Jack in American Werewolf in London. Dominique Dunn was his sister. And
Dominic Dunn was her father.
Oh, Dominique. Sorry, Dominique.
Dominique. I know. I always thought it was a bit weird when I was trying to read. Because did you read you read the Vanity Fair?
When we talked about it on the other podcast all them years ago,
the Vanity Fair article. That was a hard read. Listen, when someone talks about grief, you can kind of like get on a level with them. When you're reading it, I feel like you give a bit more because the paper is, there's no one there. There's no one there to judge you when you're writing stuff on paper. So you are just open and freely talking of how you need to. And it's more painful to read than it is to ever hear the effect that death had on that family.
Yeah. I mean, I've done those deadly departed tours. I've been to Heather's grave a couple of times. I've been to Dominique's. I've been to the house where it happened with Dominique on one of those death tours. So you get a different perspective when you actually physically see things, you know.
Yeah.
The whole thing with Dominique was, I can't remember whether she made it to the premiere or it was just after the premiere. It was somewhere in that weird gap. Either they had just released it and it was coming out, or were about to release it.
She died on Halloween, didn't she?
Yeah. He wasn't well, that man. He was not well. And he went undiagnosed. And I think it turned out he was a schizophrenic. Roughly, I think it was something like that, her partner. He was undiagnosed with some sort of mental health disorder in the end. But so that you had those two, you know, Heather was misdiagnosed. They said she had IBS or something. It turned out to be some sort of stomach.
Said she had Crohn's disease.
Crohn's.
Yeah, said she had Crohn's disease, but she actually had a hernia and also something. It was so treatable.
Like a diverticulitis or something like that.
Yeah, it was very treatable. They misdiagnosed her. They put her on steroids. Hence the reason why she's very, very puffy.
Yeah, she didn't look. Was it three or two?
It was three. Three, yeah. She looked ill.
Was number three Tom Skerritt?
Who's Tom Skerritt?
Tom Skerritt is, he was
is that
in
the old man?
Yeah, he was in Top Gun, Big Tash, normally. He's famous for, I think it's Manchester Comic Con coming up. He was in Aliens.
Yeah. I can picture it. Yeah, I think that's three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was like Definitely. Their he was her uncle or something. He was staying.
Yeah, because the family's still in two, right?
Mm.
Mary Beth at least. Craig T. Nelson in two.
Do you know what? I can't remember two. I literally have at that point. I'm at that point where I remember one and three, because three's in the high rise flats, which is where they're staying. And one obviously is in the house, but two, I don't. It just does not stay in my brain.
I know Mary Beth. Can't think of what Mary Beth's surname is, but I know that she is definitely in two. But I don't think Craig T. Nelson is.
Because in one, we got to the point where there is the biggest controversy, isn't there, about the whole swimming pool scene.
Yeah.
And Toby was sat there and he went, yeah, I did. I used real skeletons in that scene, but we didn't tell her.
No, they didn't tell her. But as we learned from House on Haunted Hill, it's cheaper. It's actually standard practice within movie making to use real life skeletons. So for it to be, now that I know that, it's not so much of a shock that actually took place, because it's cheaper. It's cheaper to do it.
But also, I mean, if you have donated your body to science and they have done what they needed to do, and then they just articulate you into a skeleton for medical purposes to show kids, at some point that's going to need to go somewhere and not be useful anymore, because it will get too old. So they need to replace it with a newer one, or a female one, or a male one, or do you know what I mean? They'll need to show a child size one. They'll want to do different things with it. So what happens to those skeletons? Because there will be no record of the person that is. You will not know the name of that.
Oh, no, no.
Therefore, you can't go and bury them when you're done. So what do you use them for? You sell them to film companies as props. Mm-hmm. And they become part of cinema history.
Imagine that. Imagine just, I mean, obviously, well, you'll never know.
Yeah.
But your bones then just get used in, like, Poltergeist. You know, they're in a swimming pool being darted up. Oh, they're like, Goonies, probably. Mm-hmm. Used. The likelihood is if you see a real life skeleton head bones that doesn't need to be manipulated,
yeah,
the likelihood is it's probably real bone that you are looking at. And the shock factor now, after learning from House on Haunted Hill, how it's just the known thing, that's what they did. It does, it takes it out of it for this one, but still one of the greatest, actually the greatest scene in Poltergeist is Craig T. Nelson with the whole, and I know it's one of the most famous lines out of it, is that you left the headstones, but you took the headstones, but you didn't, but you left the bodies.
Yeah.
I fucking butchered that line, didn't I? It's the scream afterwards that gets me. It's the why? Listen to Craig T. Nelson screaming why. Oh, he's in Young Sheldon. He right. plays Connie Tucker, Mima. He plays her boyfriend. And you always remember Craig T. Nelson's voice and the booming voice, because he was Mr. Incredible in The Incredibles. It's he's with his age, it's starting to get a lot lower and slower. And yeah. But it's still fantastic. Oh, I love that man. I must say Poltergeist is almost like a Sunday, like chill outy. Oh, feel, it's almost like a feel good movie for me.
Well, there was a conspiracy, and again, this is hearsay because it is on the internet, and it there's nothing to say it's true or not. I read Tangina, this house is clean. That's what I do every time I clean my house. I walk around doing my Tangina impression. And you think I'm lying. Honest to God, that's the first thing I do when I sit down. I go, this house is clean.
See, you do it in that tone. I do it, this house is clean. I do it with a lower register.
I do it with the manic noise. but yeah, she had, there was a, I think it's on the IMDb as well, which doesn't mean it's fact, it just means someone's put it there. It was on the Wikipedia page, and it was on another thing I read, that she had fallen out with Toby during the making of this film because she said she thought he was on heavy drugs during the making of it, and she didn't agree with it. Therefore, she would only take direction from Stephen and what notes Stephen gave her. So, again, I don't know how true that is, but it was something I read a few times. And she said that was sad because she didn't feel like she could go to the director and get the best of the part. And I'm like, dude, you did a good job.
Everybody you did, yeah.
Tangina. So whoever directed Tangina.
Regardless of how you may look at it, your performance was fucking stellar. Like, that woman is incredible. But if there was any major problem between Spielberg and Toby in who directed this movie, neither one has ever come out and said or confirmed or denied. And according to everything I've read, they still had a very good working relationship.
Exactly. And I find that people like to make something out of nothing. And I do think that maybe this might have been the case, because he's unfortunately, obviously, Toby's gone now. He died in 2017.
Spoilers.
Sorry. but yeah, you know, so you've had 7 years of where people can start running the mill, can start making things up without them being shut down or verified or
exactly.
And Toby being the private person that he is, you don't know. And I think he would be happy to let people guess anyway. I don't think he would.
Yeah. I don't think he's talking about me. That's it. I think that's the best part about with Toby Hooper. I don't think he would give a shit. Like, the life that the Hollywood glam life, that's not his. Uh-uh. And that's very evident from trying to find out information on him.
Yeah. He was just there to do his job, turn up and go home, from what I can gather. You know, he did what he loved, and that's make movies. And when he was approached to do, which I think is the next film, I might be jumping the gun, I don't know whether the music video came between this or it came after, but he directed Billy Idol's Dancing with Myself, didn't he?
He did. It's got to be around about this time because the next movie, oh, hang on. Oh, so this is where he gets his picture deal, his three movie picture deal. And who give him that picture deal?
Spielberg, wasn't it?
No, it was William Friedrich.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
Billy Friedrich, as they called him. But yeah, it was him who gave him the picture deal. If Spielberg, if it might have been Spielberg who had something to do with it as well, but it was definitely Billy and Friedrich who they said on the interview that I watched on the post-mortem one. And this is where he did Life Force.
Right. Now, Life Force for me, I went to a horror movie festival back, I mean, we're talking many years ago, about 10, 12 years ago in Leeds, which if any of the listeners know which I'm talking about, it was run by Paddy and Marlon Dingle. So Dominic Brunt and Mark. They
Wow. Okay.
basically
That's very, for that's for any of our American listeners, it's a very English pair right there.
they are famous for being in a soap called Emmerdale. And Dominic Brunt, who plays Paddy Dingle, every year, obviously on and off now since COVID, but prior to that, every year they ran a horror. They're both absolutely horror obsessed.
Did not know this.
And they run a film festival at Headingley Cricket, in Headingley in this cinema. And Life Force was playing, and it's a 12-hour, consistent 12-hour movie after movie after movie film festival. So you're there from 12 midday till 12 at night.
Wow.
And they showed so many films, and I remember they showed Poltergeist. It was the first time I ever got a dip in the toe with that film, and I will say, oh, it's something that's going to be really hard for me to ever watch again because adult babies. But that was
No.
Lloyd Kaufman, and it was trauma at its best and the worst. We saw Dominic's movie that came out at the time. There was a couple more because he directs horror movies. A lot of people don't know that.
Oh.
He's done quite a few horror movies, Dominic. Lovely man, because I stopped by and I had a chat with him because I've been talking to them on the internet prior about sponsoring it moving forward. Popped my head in and spoke to the pair of them in the green room before I went up. And really, really nice people. And they genuinely have a love for horror. You can tell it's not, oh, we're these people and we're putting this on. It's
What?
we love it.
Yeah.
And they had Life Force showing.
Oh,
And I'd
wow.
never heard of this movie until I'd sat down and watched it. And what the hell was that? Space vampires.
I've heard
Space
it,
vampires.
but it's on the level, it's meant to be satire, and it's on the level of,
Subtle.
is it so subtle?
Again, it's subtle. You've got to know that it's funny to appreciate the humor. Because to be
Right.
fair, if you're watching that, you don't. I personally wouldn't have gone to funny straight away. For me, it was like seemed like it was taking itself really seriously. And knowing what I know now, if I went back and watched it, I'd probably see those things. But at the time, I didn't. I was just like, wow, this is something. This
This
is this.
it happened.
Yeah,
It
my eyes
definitely took
aren't
place.
thankful. I have to say, but.
But I feel like Life Force is probably the most, apart from Texas Chainsaw, is probably the most true to form Tobe Hooper film.
Right.
That's the impression I'm getting from a lot of the things that I was, like the articles that I was reading, is that because there's this one, there's Life Force in 85, Invaders from Mars in 86, and then Texas Chainsaw 2 in again in 86, and there's a level of humor that I feel like can be missed for that's just really stupid. Like that's just a stupid film. And I feel like Texas Chainsaw, from the look of it, the aesthetic of it, and the look of Leatherface at the time can be portrayed as that is just really bad choice, really stupid. But I feel like that's his level of humor.
I think it peaked when it was odd for the first time out of one of his films. T2 was where it actually was the you could see it. It was there. It wasn't subtle. It was in your face. Whereas with Life Force, I saw an interview with a couple of the actors, and they were saying, it was 6 months shooting in London. I think they were at Pinewood or one of the studios in London, and it was continuous wire work for 6 months. And he said it was just the most grueling, you
Oh.
know, for one shot it would take a day.
Yeah.
And he was like, I'd never wish that on anybody, but would I go back and do it again? Yes. He said, I loved every second of it, which was really weird compared to what other people were saying about how hard it is to work with him. He was agreeing it was hard to work with him, but the outcome was worth the 6 months for Life Force. But Life Force is very much a cult movie now. And I think
Yeah.
it has been explained that it's humorous now more so than before. I mean, I just didn't get it because I didn't know anything about the film at the time when I saw it. So if I went back and watched it with fresh eyes today, it'd probably be a different thing. But
Oh,
knowing I'd already
yeah.
seen it, I didn't really want to go back and watch it again for this. So.
I remember when my sister said you need to watch Texas Chainsaw 2, and I was like, I looked at the cover art of it and I was like, do I really need to? She went, no, you need to watch it. She went, you need to watch it because obviously it, she went, it's it, she, in her words, like, it was almost like it's that bad, it's good.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, that's good, it's good. That was a good movie. There's nothing wrong. That is such a movie of its time. It had a lot of humor in it. Bill fucking Moseley is in it.
That
Trash
came off
talking.
the back, didn't it? Of Bill Moseley did a short movie called The Texas Chainsaw Manicure.
Yes.
And it was only a short. It was something he did. Just off the back of like a whim, I think. I don't think it was a college thing or anything like that. I can't really remember the story behind it, but he did this short, and it turned out that he had a friend that had an office like 2 doors down from Toby Hooper. So his friend marched the video in and showed it to Toby and gave it to Toby to watch. And basically, his friend then said, "Right, call Toby. Here's Toby's number. Whenever you're ready." So Bill rang the house, and it turns out Toby never answered the phone anyway to anyone, but that one time. When Bill called, Toby picked up, and they had a massive conversation. And he was like, "Oh, I made the Texas Chainsaw Manicure." And he was like, "Man, that was so funny! I loved every second of it." Do you know who the guy was who played like the Ed Neil character, the cousin, inside the van? And Bill was like, "Yeah, that was me." And he was like, "Right, I've got a part for you. Come and speak to me." And so that's how Chop Top was born, off of the back of Bill doing a skit version of the movie. And lo and behold, we have Bill Moseley today. Because for me, that was Bill's breakout role,
Yeah.
Chop Chop. It was the movie that you saw crazy but funny crazy. Like
Yeah.
it exaggerated insanity but with comedy. And I love two. Two to
I
me is
love it.
quite a
Oh, it's so good.
It's the first one where Toby could actually go, "Do you know what? We've got all this money, so I don't care. We're going to do this underground cave where the family live, and we're going to do this, and we're going to have the big scenes." And it was grandpa,
And the
and like,
music is going to be fucking banging, and we're going to have a radio DJ who's going to be even more banging. Like, how it just it's it 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 just fits its time so perfectly, and there is such a level of humor in it that I'm like probably more understanding of it now than I was, because now I'm starting to looking at the rest of his movies after this.
there's nothing.
Well, there's Spontaneous Combustion in the 90s, which was a television movie. I'm Dangerous Tonight.
He did a
Night.
Masters of Horror episode, didn't he?
Yeah, Night Terrors. He directed an installment made for television of Body Bags. He's worked The Mangler, The Apartment Complex, Crocodile, Toolbox Murders, and The Mortuary. Now,
The Toolbox
two.
Murders. I'm going to just skip quickly forward to that. That is actually a
Yeah.
real life, absolutely horrific case. And
Yes.
I do not suggest anybody goes and researches that. And this is not me just saying that so you'll go and do it.
No,
The
please
Toolbox,
don't.
it absolutely, if you're into true crime, you'll already know what I'm talking about. Just leave that one alone. You don't
This,
need to go there.
I listened to a last podcast on the left episode of this, and this is the one time I had to turn it off. I've never to this day been able to finish it. The murder, oh, it's horrific, but I think this is the one. Yeah, this is the one that has Sherry Moon in it.
Yeah.
So, see, people, she can actually do something without her husband's involvement. And Julia Lando as well. The cast, but it's also a remake.
I
So,
just
yeah, this is a remake of, oh gosh, the 1978 Toolbox Murders. So this is, but yeah, the actual true crime itself, it can just stay where it is.
Yeah, it's absolutely horrifying. The in-depth, the gist of it is it's just some guys who abducted some women, tortured them, and then threw their bodies down canyons. Is the that that's the cliff notes, the summary of what happens, but it's the in-between bits that it just on
Oh.
any podcast you listen to, I listen to the True Crime and Cocktails one, and I also listen to Morbid's version, and I also listen to another one, just purely because they just were falling into that period of where you listen to one after another and after another, and then
Yeah.
this one comes in and you're just like, oof. And then you listen to another version and they bring you another level of, oh, I didn't know that. And then there's another level when you listen to another one because they find other information out about it. And it's,
I
I
think, was he the
honestly.
one, who, without going into great detail, was he the one who did the voice recordings of what the women were expected to happen to them?
Yes, he did many,
They
many, many.
got released not long ago.
Oh, no, thank you. Why
Don't.
would someone do that?
Yeah, they got released not long ago. So you would have an instruction tape on what these women were expected to happen to them. They were told exactly what was going to happen to them. And it is fucking horrific to listen to. So I beg you, do not go and look for them. They are there,
Yeah.
but do not go and look for them. Do
No.
not listen to them. Save your ears because it's not something that you want to go to sleep with on a nighttime. I'm j honestly, it's one thing that is I am interested in true crime. I am not interested in that.
Yeah, some stick with you, and that one for me, I saw that I don't forget them. It's just that when someone brings it up, I'll go, oh yeah, that one. Like we were talking about the Gareth, the MI6 agent that was in the bag recently. I knew that story straight away and I was like, oh yeah, we'll talk about that. But this one, when I saw he did a version of this, I don't know if it was made for TV, I don't know if it was a movie released or any of that,
Movie.
but like, yeah, when I saw that, I was like, why?
No, that
Why?
needs to stay where it was. And oh no. Out so yeah, Mortuary's 2000, the Toolbox Murders 2004, Mortuary's 2005. And he contributed to the series Masters of Horror. He also did Dance of the Dead in 2005, which I'm guessing is a series, and it's got Robert Englund in it.
Yeah.
But after that, starts to go a bit quiet. He did do an interview on one of my favorite horror documentaries, which is done by Mark Gatiss. Mark Gatiss being of League of Gentlemen fame and Sherlock, because he is a huge horror fan. It there is a three-part series. I think I've mentioned this a fair few times because it is one of my go-tos. It's called The History of Horror. It was on the BBC originally. You can actually find it on YouTube, all three parts of it. And it's all done in time, like all in order.
Yeah.
So he starts off with the oldies and then the middle and then where we are now. And he did do an interview with Mark for that as well. Again, as dry as sticks, as
I mean, it's sad because this man is responsible for the invention of horror movies as we know them today. Like, he is responsible for the level of violence you see in films,
Yeah.
the level of like the whole gritty documentary style of filming those. He spawned so many opportunities for filmmakers just through this one film that it's so hard to watch someone who has so much knowledge, so much creativity, so much that must be going on inside of his brain,
Yeah.
and know that he either can't articulate it because he's obviously that hard to interview, or he just doesn't give a fuck. I'm
It is,
really
it's very
torn
hard.
between the two.
Yeah, it's so hard to read between the lines. If you go and listen to any of these interviews, the tone doesn't change. The level doesn't change. And it didn't with Mark Gatiss either.
No.
Did you know he wrote a book?
I saw something about that, but I didn't look into it too much because it sort of passed me by.
He wrote two. Midnight Movie. Oh no, he only wrote the one, sorry. It was Midnight Movie. He wrote that in 2011. And the last thing that he is known to have done is supernatural thriller named Jinn, which was in 2013.
Yeah, I think I've actually seen that film, and I'll tell you for why. I went through a phase of just buying any horror movies I found, like any horror movies I
I get
found.
that. I've done that.
It was like I was working, I've just not long, I finished Butlins and I was started the job that I'm in now, so a very long time ago. And I used to have this, didn't go out much. I went out, but not much. So I used to go and spend like set myself like 20 quid and I'd go to Woolworths. And I'd go to the pound bin and you'd just buy as many as you could for that. And like it didn't matter how bad they were, you were just horror movies. And like I'd sit down and I'd watch them all. And I feel like I have seen the one called Jin. I without going back and watching it looked familiar in the clips that I'd seen. And I feel like I had it on DVD or I've got it on DVD somewhere. But yeah, I remember it being atrocious. So sorry, Toby.
Well, that is the last movie to his credit. If I just slide down, so he that might be the last movie. No, yeah, that's the last movie. The last movie was 2013, and then sadly on August 26, 2017, at the age of 74, passes away of natural causes.
Which is surprising because it looked like he was drinking alcohol all the way through that interview with Mark Gatiss.
Yeah.
If you have a look, he's got three or four cups lying straight up in front of him, and I was like, either he's really nervous and that's water, or there's something a bit more funky.
I think we get natural causes because of how the likelihood is because of how private he actually was, and to know what he really died of. There's
Yeah.
no listing of he died in Los Angeles, and there's no listing of where he is. I have watched hundreds and hundreds of videos of people who go to cemeteries, and not once does Toby Hooper's name come up. So the likelihood is he probably cremated, given to his family. That's it. That's a very, very private man by just the lack of information that's there about him. I really thought when we decided to do this, because of Texas, because of Poltergeist, we would have like a plethora of his
Yeah.
style. Like I even wrote in because to look at his credits, you really do have the two that stand out. So I actually Googled what makes Toby Hooper a great director. Not a lot of great deal came up.
No. I mean, there is like I say, there is that whole thing where people who have worked with him and worked his grueling schedules have one thing to say about him when they're shooting the films or just after they've shot the films. And then years and years later, they have a totally different opinion of him from that point because obviously maturity comes along, hindsight, success of the films that he made that they were in. And that the opinions now they have compared to the opinions they had then, like Ed Neil, if anybody asked Ed Neil about what he thinks of this now compared to what he said at the time about it being worse than his experience in Vietnam, which I'm not being funny, that's a hell of a statement to make. He will say that it was worth every second because of the value of that film now. But at the time, it was worth nothing, you know, and you can think of that coming off the back of a 110 degree. Running around in makeup, running around in that kind of weather, you don't get much time down. And when you did, you couldn't really de costume much because you didn't have the ability to constantly have it reapplied, taken off, put back on. You know, it's like it wasn't just a mask. There was more to it than that. You know, like a lot of people don't realize. They think, oh, he just stuck a little mask on and that was it. There was more to it, all of that. Imagine this is the other thing, right, about movies that people don't realize. Due to continuity, they don't wash their clothes. So they could be shooting. This is the thing, they could be shooting a scene for a month, one scene for an entire month, where these people have probably two or three versions of that one outfit that they have to wear for that entire maybe minute and a half, 2 minutes that we see. They've been wearing those clothes for a month. They don't get washed. They don't get that they're stinky. They are vile. They're covered in whatever they need to be covered in. You imagine doing a 110 degree shoot in clothes that you've been wearing for an entire thing up to that point. These clothes could get up and walk off of you.
No, thank you.
And especially on an indie budget, you'll only have one costume. You're not getting three or four or five versions of the costume. You're getting one. You have to get into this reeking, filthy outfit every time. And for the fact that they weren't paid, people don't realize how little they were paid for Texas Chainsaw because there was no money.
There was
It
nothing.
was such a low budget film. The money wasn't there. Gunnar made his name doing any sequels that he was participating in any other movies he did it. He made his money through merchandising deals or appearances or things like that. And it's the same with like a lot of the guys will say that when they were doing the smaller budget films with him, there was no money to be made. You were there for the love of the film. You were there for the love of the movie.
Of course, for the experience, for the storytelling, the reason you wanted to do this in the first place. You
And
can't put money on the forefront.
that's where I feel Toby sits. Toby is a storyteller. Toby is a fantastic ideas man. He can execute what he, his vision so well. But it's a shame that either he didn't allow himself to go further into the more.
Almost commercial, like, as in,
That's it. Yeah, I feel like he maybe stunted his himself because he couldn't have the control in the bigger movies that he, as a person, may have needed to make a decent, successful film. Like he would never recreate the success of Texas Chainsaw purely because he was in a headspace of a 20-something-year-old coming out the back of Vietnam. It was supposed to be an incredibly political yet funny movie. I didn't get any of that. I did not get political. I did not get.
I didn't. Oh, what did I read? It was more the kids. It was the kids and the adult. I don't know. I don't get political. I'm not even going to try and pretend to work that out.
And
My
I
brain
genuinely
doesn't
don't
work
know
that
if it
way.
was lost during the editing or it was just never really the storyline. It was never inferred. It was never put in. It's like the thing as well that he did say one thing. He said, I don't know whether it's him or Mick in that interview that said they are a bunch of cannibals, but you never hear the word cannibal in Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
No, you don't.
You never
Hence the
hear the
reason why I
word.
can watch it. But that's it.
So,
but I know that's what they do. Because
but yeah, it's.
it's evident around them.
I can't work out what that's got to do with the Vietnam War because A, I wasn't in the Vietnam. I don't know the atrocities that took place during Vietnam. I don't even want to know because I am not in a place where I can't empathize, I can't sympathize, I can't I will never be in that situation. I just won't. And it's simple as that, things that people have to do to survive in war situations are things that I can't, my brain will never comprehend.
No, and I don't think we could ever even try and get on that level.
No.
Can't.
So if you're trying to put undertones of that into a movie that people are not coming to watch as a Vietnam protest slash political stance movie, I can't get my head around where he was, where that was supposed to be. But again, like I say, I didn't have that experience. I didn't have the nom sickness that these poor people had. So I mean, they might go and watch it and see every single thing.
Yeah, they could see a completely different movie to what we do, but I take away from Texas Chainsaw a lot more than what I expected, and it wasn't of the whole, I could kind of overlook the cannibalism side of it and look at it more of a human kind of level as well. I don't want to go too much into Poltergeist because I really want to get deep into Poltergeist one day. Even though a lot's already been covered, there's still so much to that movie than just the conspiracies, the deaths. There's much more to it. But
I mean,
I'm all out of Toby Hooper stuff.
same. I mean, I will say, out of all of his characters, there are probably three for me that are the, well, four that are classed as iconic characters. Obviously, Leatherface himself. Chop Top is probably,
Absolutely.
Bill Moseley is doing a Chop Top costume photo shoot at For the Love of Horror this year. So
Yes.
I would highly advise. I mean, obviously he's had this accident. He's not cancelled yet.
Touch wood, I don't think that's him. I think if he can, he will.
Yeah,
He'd have to he yeah.
he's a hard worker, is Bill, for conventions and things, but he's doing a Chop Top photo shoot at For the Love of Horror. Heather O'Rourke, Carol Ann, because everybody says it, Carol Ann. It's one of those things, just standard. Every kid of I was the same age,
My mom's name.
and she has the my hair was exactly like that.
Oh no, I
I
never
looked
had that
exactly like
fringe.
her.
My forehead can't carry that fringe.
Yeah, she when I was the same age, it was all a thing. And then obviously Tangina. Obviously, she isn't that iconic, but she's up there for, like,
I think
just the
she
lines
is.
alone.
Oh,
So
I
for
think she
me,
is.
Toby Hooper is responsible for at least four iconic horror figures in my back catalogue, at least.
I'm gonna have to agree with every single one of them. Every single one of them.
Yeah, that's where I am. So thank you, Toby Hooper,
Yeah,
very
thank
much.
you.
But Jesus Christ, man, you made this one hard.
You made it very difficult. Because when you think about it, it's like, oh God, yeah, there would there be so much. But there'd be so much of the movie. There's not so much of the person.
No.
And that's what's made this one really difficult. But I feel like we did it.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it wasn't as yeah, I hope we did a good job. So.
I hope so. I think it's been interesting. There's been some interesting talks in it. But next week's going to be whole different kettle of fish.
We'll be in the batshit territory with this next one. Yeah.
Yeah, the next one is it a cult classic?
I'd definitely say it is, yeah.
Yeah, because it's got such a following. It has its own merchandise. You can even get your own Christmas decoration for this one.
I'm sure Pure Horror has it, yeah.
She does.
Yeah.
I hate the fact that I know that, but she has her videos on YouTube of her Christmas tree. I know she does. Yeah, we're doing Basket Case.
We are.
I could have crickets or something. Oh, tumbleweed. But no, I'm really looking forward to it. We were talking about this before we came on. It's one of those, it's a movie I can dare say I've not seen, but my friends will disagree with that
Yeah.
because they will always bring up the fact we used to watch it all the time. I can't remember it. So this is going to be interesting. There's a lot of practical effects in here. There's a lot of makeup in here. So it's going to be a very different conversation from today. There's going to be something to talk about.
It lives in the land of Pumpkinhead for me. Like, if I was to do a list of 80s movies that are on the fringe of what I remember and slightly monster movie, they're not, but you know what I mean, they live in that same
Yeah.
land. This is where this one lives in the Pumpkinhead land, but for me, Basket Case, it definitely has that kind of
I
ridiculous
loved when
vibe
we
to
did
it.
Pumpkinhead. I
Yeah.
mean, I couldn't believe what I was watching, but I loved it.
Yeah, something. As with all movies, there's
They
something.
are something. Well, we are on YouTube every Monday at 8 o'clock. The audio for this episode and every other episode that is associated with Nerdy Up North is available on a Tuesday. The links for Bleeding Marvelous, Nerdy Up North, and Monsters Up North are where, Dan? You're very eager, Beaver. Are you trying to show your new nails off?
No, but I am not. But yeah, down there somewhere.
Very pretty. Yes, they are down there. Oh yeah, please remember, like, share, and subscribe. Hit the notification bell so you don't miss any episodes from the Nerdy Up North guys. Is that it? I always stumble at this point.
Yeah, that's it.
I mean, I get the opening done like really well now to the point where I don't even have to read it. Like, but the ending, I'm like, eh. What have I covered that? Oh, well, if there's nothing else to say, then say goodbye, Dan.
Bye, Dan.
Stay spooky, everyone. Bye.